Are you a racist?
Absolutely not. No way. Oh, no, are you being serious? Because who would ever say that they would be? I mean, that's kind of silly. I think that we all probably can help to some degree.
Get everybody on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative presents Earth on the Air.
During the next half hour, Earth on the Air's independent contributors explore aspects of race in the 90s.
We'll tour a South Chicago neighborhood suffering from what's been dubbed environmental racism.
We'll take a look at racial diversity in the environmental movement.
Also, an essay on the roots of racism in this country.
Storytelling, thoughts from the streets, and more.
We'll start off with a visit into the memory of Seattle performance artist John Mullen.
For 3 days, I stood under a yellow and white striped canopy in pouring warm New Orleans rain, listening to soul-shaking gospel groups from Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. The edge of a hurricane was blowing by, and on the afternoon of the third day, a brilliant hot sunshine took over the skies, turning the wet ground into steam and the music into the shouting mouth of God. My feet were plungers in the wet mud as I left the Jazz Festival fairgrounds under the now orange sky. My body was a humming high-powered cable replaying the music of the day, music that came to me like an angel's lips brushing against my ear, whispering that everything could always be as wonderful as I was feeling right at that moment, no matter where I was. I decided to find a new way back to my hotel, so I turned down a side street. Red clouds on the horizon were reflecting off the windows of old wood houses. "Where y'all heading?" A black man approached me. "The French Quarter. You mind if I walk with you?" Over his shoulder was graffiti that read, "Estelle Mae Brown knows a good man when she sees one." I thought Estelle was trying to tell me something. "Come on, I'd love the company." We passed a house where a thin young man's hardened white face and body were bent around a wooden post on his front porch. He glared at us like a coiled snake ready to bite. "I can tell you ain't from around here. You know how I know?" I thought he was going to say because I was wearing lime green shorts and red sneakers, because I only dress like that when I'm out of town. "I can tell you ain't from around here because you ain't prejudiced, and some people around here is prejudiced." We came to a store with a wood awning covering the sidewalk and 100 moths holding on to the front window. "We better get something to drink here." At first, the store's fluorescent lights felt like someone pressing on our eyelids. I put an apple juice on the counter and he slid a Coke next to it. I paid for both. "I like you, and I'm going to tell you something you got to know about me. I ain't never spent a day in jail in my life, and I ain't never going to. Now that's something you got to know about me." Turns out there were a lot of things I had to know about him, and he told me every one of them. He said his name was Michael, and that he knew a shortcut back to my hotel. "Come on, we get there faster this way." He headed down a dark side street. I didn't want to not follow him because of prejudice, and the music was still playing in my body, reminding me that maybe things can be all right no matter where you go. "I got a place I want to show you on the way." He took me into a restaurant with thick carpeting, velvet drapes, and violin music. "They got hamburgers here for only $9. Now that's good for all they give you." "Thanks for asking, Michael, but I'm really not hungry." I left, and Michael followed, yelling at me, "You gotta eat sometime, man, and I'm showing you the good places." I couldn't relax enough to eat, but I didn't want to tell him that. The street gutters were gradually filling with litter, which is no big surprise in New Orleans, but that night it was really bothering me. We were in the business district of an all-black neighborhood, and all of a sudden my arms and legs got really skinny and white. "Nobody's gonna mess with you around here 'cause you're with me. You ain't got nothing to worry about." He took me into a diner. We sat on round, wobbly stools at the counter. Two black men came up behind us. "Michael, my man, I give you my digits, you don't give me no ring. When we gonna get the hookup, brother?" "We get the hookup, man, maybe tonight." I was sure they were speaking in code about a drug deal and thought that maybe Michael was going to rob me for the money. There was a bus at the light in front of the diner. I tried to get myself to stay in my seat, but all of a sudden I was running for the door. "Get back here, man! Where are you going?" "I'm going to take this bus back to my hotel. That bus ain't even going where you want." I pounded on the side of the bus. The driver slowly opened the door. Michael got on with me. "Why are you acting like this? You're making me feel bad." "Like what? I decided not to walk. This bus ain't even going where you want. Come on, I get you back to your hotel." "Look, man, I don't know you. I gotta take care of myself. All I want is something to eat. If you buy me something to eat, I'll get you home safe." I wanted to believe him, but nothing in my mind or body would move. He finally got off the bus. That night, I laid awake in my hotel room, trying to get the music to play again in my body, but all I kept wondering was what would have happened if I followed him, and why couldn't I trust him?
How do you think racism manifests itself most in our culture now?
There's just another situation that happened, of course, back in the past.
The old boy network has fallen down, but it's been replaced with kind of an invisible network.
You still see people looking down towards, I see towards blacks. Because, I mean, they said there's a difference between black people and niggers, and there is, but there's a lot of white people who are bad, too.
Do you think racism is on the rise?
I'm just going to say one thing. You join the military, you'll find out.
You think that racism is in now?
I don't like to class racism as a fad. I think it's something that's predominant in the society, and it's not a fad. It's an ugly truth.
Do you think racism affects everyone, no matter what their culture is?
Everyone, because if there is anything against anyone, it harms everyone.
Why do you think racism is increasing?
Hard economic times make people more suspicious.
Are you a racist?
No, I'm not at all. I don't think I am.
I mean, people in my family stereotype sometimes, you know, but that's just the old, you know, stereotype.
Do you think you'd feel comfortable living in a neighborhood that was mostly not white?
Probably not, no. But then I'm not racist at all.
You know, as you get older, you get out of racism, I think. You know, I treat people as people, you know.
Well, do you think that people of color can be racists, or is
it... Yes! Oh, yes.
Very much so. Sometimes we can be our own worst enemies.
I think everybody has a little bit of bigotry in them, you know. It's just, there's nobody here that can say that, no, I'm not prejudiced, because there always is.
Because you got, you know, you live around the older people in your family, and then, you know, they tell you the stories which put ideas in your head, and it just rubs off on you, and then you start portraying that to the people. Yeah, it's just passed down through generation, but sooner or later it'll die out, though. I'm pretty sure. I'm getting better at it every day. So.
You too?
You're listening to Earth on the Air. My name is Charles Hunter. I'm a defense investigator in Seattle. I'd like to take a moment to share with you a couple of incidents from my life. Incidents that are typical of what people of color face on a regular basis. Late one Saturday night after a party, I stopped in the 7-Eleven for something to eat. The only people in the store at that time of night were the clerk and two policemen who walked the beat in my neighborhood. "Good morning," I said. Then I picked up a bag of nacho chips, put them on the counter, and reached for my wallet. That fast, before I had my hand in my back pocket, the two policemen had my arms twisted behind me and my face pressed down on the counter. They had their guns to the back of my head. One of them said, "Don't move a muscle or your ass is mine, boy." I couldn't have moved anyway. I was so scared. They patted me down, went through my wallet, and gave me the third degree. Then they let me go. They said they thought I was reaching for a gun. I got back to my apartment in a hurry and spent the rest of the night trying to get over the shock. The next incident was worse. I had moved by this time, and I was still pretty new to the neighborhood. I'd had a long, stressful day at work, so I went jogging to unwind. I started out at about 10 p.m. I was just beginning to pick up the pace when I saw flashing lights. A police car shot up on the sidewalk in front of me, then another beside me, and another behind. I was boxed in. Six officers got out with guns drawn and aimed at me. What are you doing in this area? Why were you running? Do you have any identification? I had identification, but my driver's license didn't satisfy them. They said it wasn't mine. I asked for it back, held it next to my face, and said, "Are you guys blind? This is me." All six said it wasn't. It was just another black face to them, I guess. They asked for more ID. I gave them my birth certificate, my bank card, and finally my ID from work. That one seemed to stun them a little. They handed it all back, put away their guns, and explained that I fit the description of someone who had just committed a crime. I'd heard that excuse more than once before. But I think they let me go because the last piece of identification showed that I work in the system, just like them. I wish I could know the system is working for me, regardless of the color of my skin.
You have reached war. Fight Aryan resistance.
What have you done for your race today?
Is everybody here white?
An ongoing war with the enemies of our race.
You're not white. Is everybody here white?
The white racist movement.
Everyone's all, yeah, we're all white.
Maybe kick some ass.
They had no direction. I wanted to basically give them some kind of direction.
He likes to control me.
Well, that tells you something. Yes, sir.
And you know that cesspool of non-white hordes. You wrote this, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Down on your hands and knees and kissed my boot. This guy, he got down on his hands and knees, and I kicked him.
Well, that tells you something. Yes, sir.
Don't get mad. Just get even.
Don't you understand? We're in your colleges.
You're not white.
Sick and tired of seeing Uncle Tom here.
I know.
Up, trying to be a white.
Go ahead, Droy. Go ahead.
Is everybody here white?
This is Earth on the Air. My name is Mike Riley. I'm Korean on my mother's side of the family, so I'm especially sensitive to the explosion of Asia bashing I've seen in our media recently. The spectacle of hatred and anger toward people who are different is simple spiritual ugliness. Most of us don't consider ourselves racist. But is it possible that you and I have assumptions and beliefs in common with racial bigots? I talked to Esther Lucero, Director of Multicultural Ministries in Seattle.
There is this myth of who we are as Americans as being primarily European. I'm from New Mexico. My parents' house that they've lived in has been in the family for almost 200 years. We're not exactly new here. We didn't cross the border crossed us. I'm a mestiza, I'm a mixture between the Spanish and the Indian. Intergenerationally, I am part of this thing called North America.
The border crossed us. There were people living here before the Europeans came and systematically took away their land. The people who came after the first European arrivals, the African slaves, and the next wave of immigrants, had to fight long, arduous battles to have recognized rights. The founders of the United States created new rights for themselves, but routinely denied rights to the indigenous people, to women, and to the landless. A myth justified this society, the myth of European manifest destiny. The myth of a North America solely of Europeans still beckons to many people. Members of the Posse Comitatus, the White Aryan Resistance, the Neo-Nazis, the so-called Christian Patriots. Here is Ken Toole of the Montana Coalition for Human Rights.
There's also a theology called Christian Identity that almost all of these groups ascribe to. That's the theology of the Aryan Nation Church, Jesus Christ Christian, is that white Northern Europeans are God's chosen people, Jews are descendant of Satan, and everybody else is virtually a different species. That runs through the whole movement from Christian patriots out to the Aryan Nation. And what we found is we've worked on this issue in Montana and become familiar with the organizations and individuals, is that they are there are connections between those groups, and while they appear to be separate and the issues they talk about are different and the forums they choose to get active in are different, they meet with each other, they talk to each other, they look at the same kinds of literature.
The organized racist movement is finding its way back into mainstream politics, from George Bush's Willie Horton race baiting to David Duke's white identity politics.
We're seeing more of a conscious strategy decision on their part to mainstream their message. And now, instead of talking about African Americans, we hear code words, welfare mothers. We hear quotas, affirmative action. So I think, in fact, that the racist right wing has made tremendous impact and tremendous inroads into legitimate politics.
With immigrant bashing, Indian bashing, Asian bashing, gay and lesbian bashing, homeless bashing, and every other kind of bashing, our diverse, rich, multiracial society is being attacked by those who believe in a European-rooted exclusivity for a future United States, which is, of course, a myth. It always has been.
Michael Riley is a freelance writer in Seattle. Next on Earth on the Air, the environmental movement historically hasn't done a very good job of involving ethnically diverse communities. Or is it that ethnically diverse communities haven't done a very good job of getting involved in the environmental movement?
In the past, minorities and people of underprivileged classes have been concentrating on the survival mode. So environmental issues were not important because their concerns were the day-to-day living.
Helena Grant is an officer for the Washington State Rainbow Coalition. She's also on the board of Washington's Environmental Council. A mission of hers is to get people thinking of social and environmental issues as interconnected.
You cannot look at one without the other. In order to be concerned about how you survive day to day, you're also going to have to be concerned about what kind of earth you're going to live on while you're surviving.
There are a lot of reasons environmental and social service organizations haven't been working well together. One reason, according to Grant, is that they've been competing for the same limited resources and funding. That, she says, needs to change.
The environmentalists must say, no, we won't accept a state budget that takes away from education and welfare and health. And while minorities, persons of colors, must say, no, we won't accept a state budget that takes away from a healthy water, healthy air, and protection for our environment.
Jeff Cook agrees with Grant that it's time for the two types of activists to learn to work together. Cook is National Director of the Environmental Careers Organization, a Boston-based group that tries to get minority students involved in environmental issues. He says, besides competition, another problem has been that environmentalists have limited the way they've defined themselves.
The current definition of environment is a very narrow one. It's bugs and bunnies, it's trees, it's wilderness, it's outdoors, it's what have you. And it has to be a far more holistic definition that includes housing and health and nutrition and education and job development and crime, and because those are all environmental issues.
Cook calls these problems environmental for one big reason. As long as they persist, communities have neither the resources nor the will to adopt what Cook describes as a conservation ethic. That is, each individual in each community taking personal responsibility for his or her environment. Patrice Watkins, an African-American sophomore at Garfield High School in Seattle, is active in the environmental movement.
A lot of minorities are worried about the communities they live in and what they can do to better the community as far as the people go, you know, the gangs and the drugs. And they kind of put what they're going to do to clean it up, you know, environmentally, they kind of put that second. You know, a lot of whites, you know, don't have that problem. Maybe they live in a nicer neighborhood.
Watkins is an intern with the Environmental Careers Organization. She says one of the biggest roadblocks to diversity in environmentalism is simply a lack of knowledge about the issues, as well as the expanding opportunities available in environmental fields. The solution, Helena Grant says, is to spread the word, door to door.
Anytime a person is educated and is knowledgeable on facts, you cannot continue to ignore a situation. If you take, for example, that you know that there is a waste product or a company that is allowing their waste products to be centered in an area close to your child's school, with that knowledge, you cannot continue to ignore that fact, knowing that those waste products and chemicals are going to affect your children.
It's this personal knowledge of how environmental degradation affects communities, Grant says, that ultimately gets them involved. And poor minority communities, she adds, have been targeted by industries because they've tended not to fight back. This Grant calls environmental racism.
The reason why we have environmental racism has been because manufacturers are always going to take the easier route as far as how to produce their product or get rid of their excess. They're going to take an easier route, and if that happens to be in a community that is less resistant to them coming into it, that's where they're going to go.
Environmental racism is a term some take issue with, insisting that communities are exploited, not because of race, but because they are uninformed and economically disempowered. But according to a 1987 United Church of Christ study, 3 out of 5 Black and Hispanic Americans live in areas with uncontrolled toxic waste sites. Activists like Helena Grant say it's time for those communities to come together, get informed about their environment, and involved in finding solutions.
Next on Earth on the Air, let's visit an economically disadvantaged South Chicago neighborhood that's been plagued for years with the detritus that its wealthier neighbors have refused to allow in their backyards.
Make a right, a left here. Take your time, go slow.
Hazel Johnson has lived in a public housing project called Altgeld Gardens for almost 30 years. Johnson's giving Diane Michael, a Chicago social worker, a tour of the environs surrounding the project. The sludge plant, the steel mill, the paint factory, the landfill, the incinerator, and the vacant lots and dumpsters where fly dumpers bring illegal and hazardous wastes from the wealthier neighborhoods.
We're going to turn right here, but hold up for a second. See, down there where that dumpster is, yeah. The trash can is. Uh-huh. Now, that area used to be years ago until I started complaining about it, that people from all different parts of the city of Chicago would dump the chemical barrels and leave them there.
This particular dumpster is pretty clean now. That's because Johnson and her neighbors started complaining. But this area of town would have to be completely overhauled to meet basic environmental living standards. 60 years ago, Altgeld Gardens was built on a landfill, and residents say they can still smell the stench rising through their basements. The current landfill's no bed of roses either.
So here we are. We're at the landfill, and what is this? Some kind of lagoon or what?
This is Calumet River.
Oh.
It's a little Calumet River. Look at it. Even to clean it up would take 75 years to clean it up. And if they could clean it up then. From all these factories and Water Reclamation District, the sewer treatment plant, I heard that was our biggest polluter, and which it is. Because when they put that sludge out to dry, oh my God. Does it make you sick?
It smells awful, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it makes your apartment smell just like human waste, decomposed bodies. And during the summertime, you can smell it much better.
But you guys, are you used to it by now, or not something you really get used to, is it?
It's something that you really can't get used to.
Because it smells so bad.
It smells so bad, and it makes you so sick. I know it makes me nauseated. Some people say it make them have severe headaches. Some people say that they throw up. So it's just something that a human shouldn't have to smell.
Hazel Johnson says residents of communities like Altgeld Gardens become, like it or not, experts of sorts on pollution and hazardous waste.
And you know, when you're living in a community, when we smell that odor, we know where it automatically comes from.
Right.
If we smell paint, we know it's coming from one or two places, Sherwin-Williams or Ford Motor Company, because they paint their cars there. So we know all of this.
A few years ago, Johnson started studying environmental issues and legal maneuvers that would help her fight further exploitation of her community. She organized a citizens' movement called People for Community Recovery, which has successfully fended off another neighborhood landfill. But Johnson's success story is not typical. More often, poor communities just don't fight back. With all the pollutants floating around, Johnson says, citizens usually feel too sick or drained to organize effectively. And, of course, their main concern is often basic survival.
Or where are they going to get the next meal, or where they're going to get the next pamper for their kids, or whatever.
How have you tried to get past that?
By going to door-to-door. We pass out flyers. We inform people that it is a hazard to our health. And a lot of people realize it because of we know there's a lot of cancer within our community. We know there's a lot of cases of asthma. And they know something is wrong. Because sometimes we have 2 and 3 funerals in a month with people having cancer. So it's a big problem.
Poor people and people of color bear the brunt of most environmental hazards. 4 out of 5 Latinos and African Americans in the United States face uncontrolled hazardous waste sites near or in their community.
We were questioning
air pollution,
why cervical cancer was already so high in the community,
water pollution,
why other forms of cancer are so high,
greed.
Little did I realize that our own government was allowing us to be killed slowly. In a different
manner.
She was
the very first one to start having seizures and nosebleeds.
Chronic diarrhea,
dizziness. She's very weak. She weighs 38 pounds.
Heart problems. Skin rashes severe where they bleed on and off.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see some kind of pattern developing here. Where are the toxic waste dumps? They're not in Beverly Hills.
Companies like Westinghouse.
Companies like General Electric.
Discharge. Green.
Polychlorinated solvent.
Slowly. In a different manner.
The average yard that they tested in Oakland. Classified as a toxic waste site.
Racism.
We never questioned the health department because we thought it was set up to protect the people.
People tend to believe
economics
that lawyers and scientists
four
and
out of
judges
five economics
we're questioning
will solve
dizziness
the problem
slowly.
We never questioned
manner.
Chronic diarrhea.
We
questioned doesn't get enough oxygen.
Like general electric.
Four out of 5
we're
questioning where the toxic waste
comes from.
We never
questioned.
That montage was from several environmental issues conferences. The tape was collected by Sophia Martinez, who lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Katrina Snow, who lives in Portland, Oregon. It was produced by Seattleite Peter Young.
The interview with Chicago community organizer Hazel Johnson was from Diane Michael. That's the show. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, it's your program, too. Send for a copy of our submission guidelines or find out about any of the pieces you heard.
Write us at Earth on the Air, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
That's P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, 98145.
Earth on the Air Submissions Director is Susan Gleason. Our Executive Director is Craig McDonald. The show is produced and edited by Peter Maloff.
We had help from Ted Gates, Tom Baer, Lowell Harvey, Lowell Del Alba, Scott Bergen, Jean-Paul Bardu, and Bill Svoboda.
Music was from David Hines, 5 Blind Boys, Paris, Jake Davies, and Randy.
Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle and KSER in Linwood, Washington.
Partial funding was from the Town Creek Foundation, the New Roadmap Foundation, and Jennifer and Ted Stanley.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-735-0230. Mention that you'd like program number 15. For the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative, this is Peter Maloff.
And I'm Janice Kane.